Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And we are expecting to hear from Roya Hakakian, who is an Iranian-American poet, journalist, writer, and television producer for programs like 60 Minutes. Her latest book is Assassins of the Turquoise Palace, a nonfiction account of the Mykonos restaurant assassinations of Iranian opposition leaders in Berlin. Roya Hakakian is a founding member of the Iranian Human Rights Documentation Center and serves on the board of Refugees International. She has an article in the New York Times International Weekly, Where Did Iran's Green Movement Go? And I don't quite know what's happening here, whether for some reason or other she's booked to be on and we haven't been able to get in touch with her. So until we do, I will, you know, I will attempt to tell you what it was that we were planning on talking about here, because we've been trying to cover, obviously, for a couple of years now, the possibility of a war with Iran, either a war started by Israel with or without U.S. permission, or a war that may indeed follow the elections. There's no question that the sanctions that the president has put in place since he signed the National Defense Authorization Act, he did threaten to veto that act because he felt that it would push the price of oil up during an election year, which it clearly has, although we have done lots of programs indicating that the real driver of the price of oil on the global market is, in fact, speculation on Wall Street. Just a few days ago, the Saudi oil minister said there is no rational reason for the price of oil to be where it is. And of course, the Saudi are the ones that are making up the shortfall as the squeeze is put on Iran. And what the president's apparently been doing is assuring customers of Iranian oil that they can find alternative suppliers. And apparently they have managed to basically squeeze Iran. And I think the squeeze is now beginning. So the purpose of the interview today was to find out about what would happen in terms of the domestic reaction to this squeeze, whether this would bring about, when a people are in such distress, both economically, with the sanctions, of course, have hurt the economy enormously, but so much of the Iranian economy is dependent upon, at least in terms of the standard living of people and their ability to purchase food and gasoline due to generous government subsidies. So if 60% of the government's revenues dry up, clearly it's going to have some severe ramifications for the Iranian people. So what we're trying to determine here today was whether or not these tightened sanctions and economic distress will revive the Green Movement or turn the Iranian people against the West. There seems to be a divided opinion amongst Iranian experts on that. Now, the last interview I did on Iran just on Sunday was with a specialist from the RAND Corporation who was sent by the Bush administration over to Iraq during the Iraq war to investigate the Mujahideen, which is the MEK they're called. And it was a very disturbing picture because the MEK, apparently, this cult-like group of Iranians who were part of the revolution, then they split away and then took refuge in Iraq, where Saddam Hussein, of course, kept them well supplied and well funded in being a part of Saddam's murderous regime and being protected by it. They've lost all credibility within Iran, but they continue to be the source of a lot of the terrorism. And the long and the short of it is that this unsavory group, which is on the U.S. terrorist list, the State Department's terrorist list, they've been trying here in the United States to get themselves off the list and has been spending enormous amounts of money on paying hefty lecture fees to senior Bush administration people. So the long and the short of it is that people like Tom Ridge, the former head of the Homeland Security, was being paid $30,000 to $40,000 by these people for lecturing. He's lobbying, as is the former head of the FBI, Louis Freeh, to get them taken off the terrorist list. Even Howard Dean, by the way, and Rendell. So they're getting some Democrats as well, but they're mostly Bush administration, Francis Townsend, John Bolton, the Walrus mustachioed neocon from the Bush administration. The point being that the neocons are really the ones that are using this intelligence along with Netanyahu to build a case against Iran. But the source of this intelligence is this incredibly unsavory organization called MEC. So one has to be dubious about the quality of this intelligence. The CIA and Mossad, by the way, the Israeli intelligence agency, both insist that Iran has not chosen to build a nuclear weapon, that they are at least 2 years away from that decision. They certainly are trying to enrich uranium, but that's another matter. I mean, we live with the Japanese, of course, who have tons and tons of plutonium and could go nuclear at any moment, but they aren't. And by the way, just yesterday, the Turkish prime minister was in Tehran meeting with the supreme leader, Ayatollah Khamenei, and Ayatollah Khamenei apparently told Erdogan that it's un-Islamic to build a nuclear weapon. So he claims that they're not building a nuclear weapon. But there isn't a really disturbing pattern here with the similarities between the build-up to the Iraq war based upon phony intelligence that Chalabi and others that the neocons were championing produced or manufactured. You know, they forged the Niger documents, the curveball, this drunken, delusional guy that the German intelligence had just recently and last week finally went on in an interview, said that he had made the entire thing up. That was the basis of the intelligence that Colin Powell presented to the United Nations. So there's a pattern here with the neoconservatives manufacturing evidence through these foreign surrogates and through people that they championed, like Chalabi, who turned out to be an Iranian agent all along and dropped the dime on the National Security Agency by telling the Iranian regime that the NSA had broken their diplomatic codes. When Bush Jr. found out about it, he went ballistic. But that's the kind of quality of the people that the neocons back. So not surprisingly, they're backing the MEC, this horrible group, and they're providing this fake intelligence that may be at the heart of much of this drumbeat towards a new war. So there are very, very shocking and disturbing parallels here, which, again, I want to do a follow-on in terms of what's going on inside of Iran and how these measures that the president's just brought forth. And, of course, the sanctions are a part of a carrot-and-stick approach, obviously, and they've never really bitten before, but it looks like for the first time ever they will get the attention of this regime, although Arguably, we've been talking past each other and for some time. And the president, when he first came in, did make some initial moves, but was quickly disappointed. So it's difficult to know exactly where the blame lies. But the Iranian regime have indicated recently that they're more willing to talk. So presumably this third or fourth, I guess, Gulf War could be avoided. And that would certainly be a good idea. But again, we've been trying to cover this for some time and stay on top or ahead of the story. Now, one thing that changed in terms of the military landscape is an interview I did a few days ago with Mark Perry, who has a big article at Foreign Policy about how the Israelis have been working for some time with the government of Azerbaijan, which is a criminal mafia government, and they've been working with them as they have with the Georgian government. They were developing air bases in Georgia, but the neocons blew that when Randy Scheuneman, who was John McCain's national security advisor, encouraged the Georgian leader, Shakashvili, to get tough with the Russians. Of course, that blew up in their face, and the Russians fell for Putin's sucker punch, and the Russians invaded, and now the air bases are not viable in terms of using them, the Georgian air bases of using them for an airstrike on Iran by the Israeli Air Force. Not that the Israeli Air Force would necessarily take off from these bases. It's more likely that they'd use them on the return leg to refuel. But now it turns out, apparently, that they've been assiduously making deals with the government of Azerbaijan, and they have air bases from the old Soviet days right on the northern border of Iran. So it's now, apparently, at least according to Mark Perry and his intelligence sources, been both in the U.S. military and in the CIA, indicate that an Israeli attack on Iran is actually feasible now, because it was always dismissed as as not being a real possibility simply because of the distances and the inability of Israel to do in-flight refueling, particularly over Iraq, which is now, thanks to Bush and the neocon stupidity, is now essentially controlled by Iran. So that was always had led military analysts over here to be skeptical that an Israeli attack would be, one, feasible, and two, effective. It probably would never be effective. But the feasibility issue is no longer, I think, very much on the table, if indeed they can refuel on their return leg, land and refuel on their return leg after striking Iran in Azerbaijan. So that is something that we want to keep watching as well. So I'm sorry that this Roya Hakakian flaked on us here, but this sometimes happens because we are a live program. So what do we learn on Background Briefing today? Well, we started out with Tim Johnson, who's the bureau chief for McClatchy in Mexico City, because the Mexican president was in Washington, D.C. at a summit, the so-called Three Amigos summit, along with Canadian Prime Minister and President Obama. And he's, of course, the lame duck. He's out of office in December. What I learned from Tim Johnson is that it's pretty clear that the pre-candidate is the front runner, most likely to win the six-year term. And, of course, Mexican presidents have enormous power. And it's amazing to think that this corrupt institutional revolutionary party, that's an oxymoron in itself, that ruled Mexico for 71 years, is coming back. They always had a deal with the drug cartels while they're in power, and presumably that is what's going to happen when they come back. There'll be less violence, but more corruption, and in many ways it's the Mexican people are just tired of the fact that 50,000 Mexicans have died for America's war on drugs. But we also talked, because Tim Johnson was also the bureau chief in Beijing for McClatchy and for Knight Ridder, and he wrote a book about Tibet, Tragedy in Crimson, how the Dalai Lama conquered the world but lost the battle with China. So I was able to ask him about what's happening with this rash of self-immolations on the part of Tibetan monks, mostly inside Tibet. Of course, Tibet is completely sealed from the outside world by the Chinese security, who's throwing a blanket over all of this. But what is clearly happening there is an act of extraordinary horror, but an act of absolute desperation, which apparently the Tibetan people feel. To them, what's happening under Chinese rule is a form of cultural genocide, and apparently the Chinese, average Chinese, have no sympathy for the Tibetans. So it's not likely to get any better. And then I spoke about the elections in Burma, where 40 of the 45 seats were won by Aung San Suu Kyi's party. She, of course, won the last elections. Has been under house arrest for 20 years from a military government that's ruled for 50 years. They appear to be making moves to get rid of international sanctions and move away from their dependence on China. What I learned from the interview with Dr. Joseph Silverstein, who's written extensively on Burma, is apparently the Chinese got the generals to agree to completely reverse the Great Irrawaddy River by damming and then diverting all that water to China, which would completely destroy the ecology of Burma, but be good for China. That apparently was the straw that broke the camel's back, and the people really revolted against it. And that's brought about this change, this little bit of democracy, obviously a step towards democracy. And then the third person, since we do a live program, for reasons I still don't understand, Roya Hakakian, an Iranian-American, she has an article in the New York Times, Where Did Iran's Green Movement Go? I wanted to talk to her about how the sanctions are now tightening on Iran. They're going to really bite, and whether the Iranian people will blame their government or blame the West. The long and the short of it is she stood me up, which is pretty disgraceful to do on a live program. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Just
Took the kids to the park and disappeared.